This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Earlier in July, crowds rioted following allegations of cheating and theft at Lau Yat Plaza. Police have since arrested the main suspect for theft and denied he was cheated, but the incident did highlight the role social media can play in inflaming an already tense situation. For more on this, I'm joined by Nikki Cheong, a lecturer and analyst on social media and journalism. Welcome to the show, Nikki.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about the Lau Yat incident briefly. Okay. You know, what's the timeline of events? At what point did social media pick the incident up and run with it?
Yeah, so I mean, all the timelines that we see are basically based on news reports. But I think the general one really was that the incident happened, the perpetrator was arrested, and then there was messages being sent out asking them to come back, a few people to come back and respond. But I think it really was what happened after that, because at that point, I think with the bunch of friends that came back first, it really was just, from what I hear, through WhatsApp and through that kind of things. It wasn't actually Twitter, Facebook and things. It was only when the big group started coming in, and then of course, Ali Dinju, who's since been arrested, and all were there, and that's when it kind of blew up. And when the media picked it up, actually very interestingly, I thought that really it was when the mainstream media and online media picked up on it, did it kind of blow up into the proportions that we now know.
Are you seeing a lot of that sort of symbiosis between social media and mainstream media, you know, where it kind of passes through this, it just goes by osmosis?
Yeah, because I think it's very interesting, right? Because I think both rely very much on each other. So when people are on social media and they see things that happen, generally they do question. I do believe that people question what they see. And a lot of times they go and check mainstream media for verification and kind of legitimization.
And then after that, they tweet the links that they find.
That's right.
And
but then just... because this is happening, which means that the numbers are coming in, what mainstream media is also doing, and I'm talking mainstream, I include on online websites and everything and all, then everybody wants to be the first to report. So then what they end up doing is that they report based on what they see on social media. And so that's when things get a bit dangerous, I think, because... things happen so fast that you can't actually verify it immediately. And then they're reporting things of allegations and things that they're reporting as rumors and stuff. But the problem is, I think general people don't understand how to read those words. So they don't actually know how to address words like alleged or based on reports and stuff.
Reported.
They see things and they kind of go, that's what happened, as opposed to, we think this happened and this might have happened. So I think that's where a lot of the problem has occurred. And this is not just with the Lau Yat case, but when the aeroplane MH370 disappeared or MH17 came down and stuff, we were seeing all these kind of things as well.
So what we're seeing then, I guess, is mainstream media picking up on rumors seen on social media and then people then picking up on those reports and legitimizing the rumors. So it's this weird cycle.
It's a huge weird cycle. And it's not just rumors, right? Because I can't remember who was it who said, always said that the first 5 minutes, Twitter is great for the first 5 minutes of breaking news, but horrible for the next few hours. It's because there's a lot of facts that go out there as well. But it's when messages get retweeted, context is taken out, and that's when problems occur, I think.
So if we look at Lau Yat in particular, did the facts of the incident get distorted on social media, in your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. The whole thing, because at the end of the day, let's face it, it became a race issue. And the race thing, I think, really came out, was blown on social media, and then of course the press kind of amplified it as well. Because if we were just to stick based on what was happening earlier, it was just this guy who had stolen a phone and called on his friends to kind of maybe show some force and things. But when it became the race issue, that I think was made out much bigger on social media platforms.
How do you think social media and, you know, the weird cycle you described earlier, how has that changed our news reading behavior in general?
I think we're still learning. So I think we've had to kind of relearn how to sort things out and information. I mean, number one is information overload, right? And number two, we had to kind of rethink about who is offering us verifiable information. Who do you trust? So there's all that kind of trust factors and all that come in. I don't think that we figured it out yet. But it's interesting if you see, I've given a couple of talks on comparing the reaction on social media with MH370 and MH17. And you can actually see that with the second one, people, there were more people going out there kind of going, check your facts before you share it. They were giving kind of more advice and tips compared to the first one, where it was kind of a free-for-all and the conspiracy theories were all coming out and that kind of stuff. So I think we are learning, but it's because the technology changes so fast that we're not there yet.
One part of it is, as you point out, how we read these news reports. But the other thing is, when you say check your facts before you share it, in a way it puts the onus of reporting on anybody, right? On even lay people sharing things. Has that, do you think that's somewhat, you know, have we, can we cope with that kind of responsibility?
No, because we've never had that kind of training. You know, we've always learned for so many years, and this is not just Malaysia, this is worldwide. We've learned to rely on the institution of the media to give us the facts, first draft of history and that kind of things. So it's not tuned in our head that, you know, we are more used to kind of private conversations. We learn the things that we know how to do is whisper when we want to tell a secret. We know how to choose who our friends are and acquaintances. So we have those kind of structures in our lives, but we haven't kind of processed the, oh, think before I tweet kind of thing, which we really, really need to start doing.
Are we, as in Malaysians, behind the rest of the world, or do you think it's a worldwide thing of us all not being able to do
it? No, I think it's a worldwide thing. I think why we see a lot more, it feels that way is, of course, we're closer to it.
Yes.
But I think second as well is, we're not a very big country population-wise, but we have a huge internet penetration, right? So we're about 70% on the internet, and we're heavy users of technology. So I think that kind of amplifies it. But then there's also, because we're also a developing country, that we have so much other issues that we attach to everything that happens on social media. So with this one, it was immediately we brought race in, when race is a whole complete total issue.
Yes.
To what happened. Whereas in other countries, you know, it's more isolated, it's more pocketed. If you come from bigger cities, you deal with things differently from the other country, other cities as well. So I think that's where it feels like it's so magnified and amplified.
Would you say we're a whole generation away from being able to think before we tweet? Are we raising digital natives who hopefully will have that ingrained?
I hope so. I do think that we are far away, because I think the problem as well is that even digital natives are not experts.
And it's also about etiquette, isn't it? I mean, you can grow up as a digital native, but etiquette is a whole other thing.
Yeah, like, I mean, like what I was saying just now, you know, the whole thing about how we've built all these kind of fences and stuff of who our close friends are, who our family, who we trust with information and things, we haven't found a way to do that online. The only thing that we have is that we can choose what kind of list to put our friends on Facebook. But that's the closest thing that we have. But, you know, we are seeing changes. And I think people, I think the media as well has started taking a bit more responsibility before they're pushing things through and stuff. Even yesterday with the death of Cilla Black, for example, the BBC got a lot of flack for not announcing it almost immediately, but they wanted to wait till, according to reports, they wanted to wait till the family had been informed before they publish it. So at least media and all are learning from these kind of things as well.
With the information overload that you've described, and which I think all of us are privy to, you know, it's just so much all the time. Have there been any global examples where a video of an incident has sparked riots because it went viral, or is it more, you know, is it more that there's just so much to choose from that, you know, you can take your pick from a buffet of rage, really?
I mean, you don't look at examples. All the revolutions in whatever we call the Arab Spring, for example, that was really based on one Facebook post and things. But again, I mean, it's so easy to blame social media and blame technology. But at the end of the day, what happened is that that post or that photo or that video came up at a time which really touched on the sentiments on the ground already. People were already feeling frustrated. People were feeling repressed. People were feeling, you know, all these things. And then this one kind of, the tipping point, you know, as Malcolm Gladwell will say. But I think one clear example would be 2011 in London, when the London riots happened. It was known as a BlackBerry revolution. And at that time, everybody was on Twitter and Facebook. No one actually saw chat apps to be able to kind of have the kind of virality and the kind of life. You know, and I think we're seeing a lot, but we're seeing it. I mean, we're talking about these bad things, negative things, but we've also seen how it's come together for good in the case of earthquakes and natural disasters and things like that as well.
What is it about social media that can make a localized incident take on global proportions? Do we know yet what may or may not touch a nerve in a country really far away?
So on Twitter, for example, there's this thing called markup culture. And it's the use of hashtags, and it's the use of the inverted commas to do to add comments to tweets and stuff like that. These things make it very easy to search for things. And the thing that we don't understand is how this social network companies work their algorithms to show us things. So we don't actually, you know, so it might be popular in one country, but if they choose to put it on the front page of their website, for example, because they think it's popular, and then everybody clicks on it, and then it just takes a life on its own. It's all these little...
And we know they've run social experiments on us as well.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, you know, Facebook has received lots of flack for running social experiments. And I, you know, we have no evidence, but I'm pretty sure that whoever has the ability to do it would have run the same thing. It's for them, it's a business decision.
Perhaps, so this is me just speaking anecdotally, but based on what I've seen, what I see on my own feeds, it seems often that things that go viral are, you know, for lack of a better phrase, seem to go west to east. You know, we seem to be looking at things that are coming to us from America or from the UK, and then we're reacting to it and retweeting or reposting it on our feeds. Whereas things that go viral locally don't seem to have the same sort of reach. You don't see, you know, friends in America or whatever tweeting or, you know. So why is that? Why is it still cultural imperialism?
Well, a little bit of that. But I think at the end of the day, it's as basic as a numbers game. We have, you know, for something to go viral here, it's going to take a lot of people to be interested in it. And in a country like Malaysia, where we speak so many different languages and some people only speak and engage in a particular language, you miss out on things. Whereas in the US and stuff, everybody is speaking English, generally it's understood. But if we had a really hit Malay hit song here, it'd be harder to reach out to the Western world, for example. So I think it's a little bit of that as well.
I'm speaking today with Nikki Cheong, lecturer and analyst on social media and journalism, and we're discussing both those things and how the interplay works in terms of what goes viral on social media. Up next, we find out whether, you know, in some way social media is narrowing our worldview. If you've got any questions, feel free to text them in to 016-201-9000. You can also tweet at BFM Radio. Good afternoon, this is Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. In the studio with me, Nikki Cheong, lecturer and analyst on social media and journalism. We're discussing what goes viral on social media. And up next, a whole discussion on trolling and bullying, which are, of course, hot topics when it comes to social media.
My favorite topics as well.
Yes. But first, when it comes to understanding news, which was what we were discussing earlier, are we more likely to believe the veracity of a picture or a story if it's posted by someone we know?
Yes and no. Generally, because what happened with social media as well is that we've, and this goes back to kind of studies of social network theory and strong ties and weak ties, is that you generally kind of associate certain people with a degree of credibility. So these are people I trust, these are people I don't. But the other thing now is that in cases of like mass convergence where you have either protests or you have fire or you have anything, or hot topics, people look for keywords, and these days credibility sometimes takes a second place if what is being said is agreeable to them, and that kind of things get shared a lot as well, and that's causing, I think, some of the problems that we are seeing on social media.
So when it comes to operating in this new world where speed is of the essence, an understanding of how to use hashtags seems to be more important than, you know, having credibility. What is the process of building credibility like as a reporter? Because it used to be that, you know, you get scoops or you're known for truthful reporting, for always verifying your facts. Now, if you want people to trust you and believe in you and come to you as their source, what do you need to do?
I mean, I can't speak for, you know, but for me, I think sometimes it pays to slow down and get a bigger picture, being able to, I think, provide the context for everything that's happening. What's happened is the last few years, the concept of live tweeting has become very popular. So if there's a press conference that's going on, you know, you sit there for 25 minutes and you just tweet everything that's being said. The thing is, with updates, whether it's Facebook or tweets or whatever, it's very short and very quick, and you can't provide a context. So I think a good journalist will be able to piece all these things together, and there's great apps out there like Storyfy and stuff that allows you to do that. But I think the other thing as well is I think that you can build your reputation through this idea of curatorship. I mean, I don't really like the word because, you know, it's borrowed, but the idea that if you have made yourself, if you're able to kind of use whatever journalistic skills that you have and the knowledge and the tricks of the trade to kind of piece things together over a long period, you generally kind of build your reputation for certain things. It's harder when you're trying to be a jack of all trades and talk about everything. So I think in these days, look for niche markets. So if you're going to talk about politics, just do that. If you're going to talk about sports and things, and I think that's how you kind of grow your name.
When it comes to, you know, weak ties, strong ties, and so on, on the other hand, you also have this effect now of social media, of Google completing your search terms, for example, and of you accidentally or inadvertently surrounding yourself with people who all support your worldview. So do we run the risk then of, you know, just kind of getting ensconced in our own little worldview and having it reinforced and enforced again?
Yes, I mean, in two ways. For sure, because what Facebook does, for example, is they keep showing you the same thing if you keep liking it. So if you like a post from a friend of yours, they'll keep showing it to you because they assume that you want to see a lot more of these things. But having said that, there has been research shown that we're not in the bubbles that we think that we are. So I think there was in US, for example, they did a survey on people who, you know, based on the Republican Party and the Democrat Party, and they found that there were quite a lot of people, up to about 30%, who were getting news that was opposed to their values. So I think, you know, there's still space for more research. The only difference now is I'm seeing, and this is anecdotally, of course, that we are choosing to unfriend people who disagree with us.
Or unfollow.
Which is a shame, because I think that, you know, it narrows your worldviews if you don't hear what other people are saying.
And a part of the reason why we do that online especially is because people get unpleasant when they have the protection of a screen and a keyboard and some anonymity. With all this trolling that happens, you know, whether it's on online forums, whether it's just on social media, what effect does this have on people feeling like they can say whatever it is that they need to say?
Yeah, I think people are still, you know, the whole adage that on the internet nobody knows you're a dog. You know, I think everybody. And that's something that we've been talking for a decade ago. People still believe that. And I think people need to stop because, number one, people think that they can say things and not get caught for it, which you can't because it's so difficult to hide these days. But the second as well is that if you keep thinking that, then you embolden yourself to say certain things that you normally wouldn't say, you know. And this comes back again to kind of pausing and thinking before you send a tweet or send an update.
Is naming and shaming on the increase, as in the Justine Sacco case, of course, or have people, as you say, learned to take that pause and think, okay, do I need to say this or not?
No, I mean, you know, you look at any time there's a incident, and I don't know whether this is particularly a Malaysian thing, but we do it a lot, right? So anytime there's an accident or something, the first thing that we do is we take a photograph and we go on the internet. And then if it becomes a really big thing, again, being tied to a lot of other social issues that we're dealing with, and people think that it's a big enough issue to play up, then they start going to the people's houses and releasing that information. It is a problem, I think, because there's a lot of things to be said about privacy. And as much as you disagree with people, what's actually worrying me is that, and this is not just on social media, this is general, that people are starting to kind of take things into their own hands without kind of dealing with authorities to do what's, you know, we're still a country run, you know, rule of law still stands.
Applies.
And I worry that we might be kind of shifting away from it a little bit. And that's something that came out as well with the Loyat incident, that some people felt that it was vigilante justice when it wasn't. But because it's in their head that this could possibly happen, that they automatically assumed that it was a bunch of people attacking somebody who's been allegedly stealing something.
Is there any... Where's the line? You know, where's the happy middle, or does it not exist? Because I think some people might feel that, okay, with this culture of bullying happening, at least I know that if I were to put myself out there online, there is the possibility of somebody defending me. And on the other hand, defending can go terribly, terribly wrong, as we see in the cases of people who show up at people's houses or get people arrested. So where's that line between being a village that stands up for one another and then being the village that runs after people with pitchforks?
Yeah, I mean... It's like being in an actual village, right?
Yes.
You can't, you know, the line is very blur. But I think that it's important for us to remember that at the end of the day, we all have our opinions, and it's so important that we respect everybody's opinions as well. I always push for diversity of thought, because if we want to talk about freedom of speech and those kind of things, if I'm entitled to believe what I want, other people are as well. I think if we kind of accept that, then there's a bit of mutual respect, and that will go a long way. The problem now is that we are so impatient with other people, and we don't believe that there can only be right and wrong, and I am right, and that is, I think, where a lot of problems are stemming from as well.
What is astroturfing, and how can it be used in a Malaysian context?
Oh, okay. So astroturfing is basically, I mean, there's a lot of interpretation. So my definition of it really is kind of a stage movement disguised to reflect grassroots sentiments. So the idea of astroturf against as fake grass against real grass. And it's actually a marketing phenomenon. It's been used marketing for a very long time. The idea of, if you want to look from that perspective, even the idea of getting celebrities to endorse certain things and stuff is considered astroturfing. So somebody to kind of amplify your brand or something that you're an opinion, and being paid for it or being asked to do it intentionally. In Malaysia, we see it in politics. There's been a lot of accusations of the idea of cyber troopers being used by the ruling party, but there's a lot of talk about the opposition having it as well, you know. So we see that, and I think they exist in different forms. So there's the ones who are just tweeting and attacking you. So if you disagree with them, they just come in, and that's all they do. They go and then fight for people who disagree with them, who may be saying things against their ideological views. But there are those who are believed as well, and research has shown some who might have been being paid to purposely kind of say certain things, orchestrated movements, you know, to share certain views, to try and push this forth, to make it look as if that this is what everybody on the ground is thinking and talking about.
How effective is it? Are people becoming wise to it? I mean, it took us a while to get used to product placement, and this sounds like sophisticated ideological placement, but at the same time, I imagine that it can be hard to point it out without sounding somewhat like a conspiracy theorist. It's like, oh yes, you know.
It's very hard. I mean, I think the biggest thing with this is that it looks like just somebody who disagrees with you and attacks you, you know. And the point is that we haven't had anybody who's admitted to doing this. There's a lot of researchers, and this academic research, where they've spoken to political parties and stuff to ask, and everybody admits that they actually have a social media unit that deals with these kind of things. But for them, it's more kind of, propaganda might be a hard word, but you know, it's a PR strategy and that kind of things. But what I think, when it gets nasty, when it gets starts being attacks as opposed to just pushing through a thought, that is when it becomes dangerous.
We've been talking about rule of law. Does Malaysia have laws that regulate the use of social media, and are these laws or codes in line with global standards?
So if you ask some people, we say that's enough. But just yesterday, the Prime Minister and the new Minister, Azalina Uthman, has asked for more cyber laws. I'm of the opinion that we don't need more cyber laws. Because what are you dealing with? Because the issue, it's so easy to always blame social media without forgetting that it's people who enable. The social media just enables people's personal thoughts and opinions to come through. We have, you know, if it's defamation, we have existing defamation laws, which would already cover anything that happens online, for example. And we have seen it in action. You know, we have had arrests of people who have posted tweets and Facebook updates and that kind of stuff. So it's in terms of the law, we have the MCMC who governs the kind of things that happen on the internet and stuff. We have the Internet Bill of Guarantees that says that there's going to be no censorship, although there are some censorships that happen. But I think that in terms of global standards, the difference is that there's, in at least liberal countries, there is the notion of free speech. And the belief and the fundamental right to that free speech. Whereas over here, we often call for free speech with responsibility. And I think that's the biggest difference.
How should journalists use social media? It's a brave new world. We've kind of been talking around it, but what would your recommendation be in terms of how old school journalists, I guess, should approach it?
I think there's two things. So one, if you want to talk about it from a branding perspective, you know, I think that everybody should be. It's a great source of information. It's a great way to connect with readers in the thought of public journalism and and that kind of school of thought. But if you really want to talk about in terms of what we do, I'm sometimes concerned that we give too much value to things that we see on social media. So often in mainstream media, we will see posts that kind of go like, on Twitter, a few people are saying this and saying that. Because we haven't found a way to actually properly calculate sentiments, right? So you might be tracking something based on a hashtag, but not everybody uses a hashtag, for example. And then we use on Twitter a lot, but then people who tweet in English might talk a lot about these things, but people who tweet in other languages might not. So that's the kind of things that we haven't actually worked out yet. And I think media organizations really need to kind of figure out how to justify what is real sentiments and what is really kind of sentiments on the ground, as opposed to just assuming that social media is this big fat focus group.
In the quest to be first or best or most, I think the temptation to use clickbait is very high, whether you use it in the headlines or in the photo that you attach to the post. So what examples, firstly, so that's a twofold question. Firstly, what examples have you seen of just really awful non sequiturs of photos or headlines used in relation to stories? And secondly, how do you kind of make sure that things are within context, since context is so important?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I want to name certain publications, but we do have in Malaysia publications that if you look at the headlines and then you read the story, you just realize that it's really just one line from the whole story that hits the headline. And this actually, to be honest, from my observation, happens a lot with online news sites because they rely more on numbers coming in. I think it's a growing problem. I have addressed this with some people before. So that's basically the first question. So yes, it's really happening and it's a problem. And I think that media organizations need to take more responsibility with those kind of things. And it's like on the other hand, it's for them, it's business. You know, they need to do this. And also, I think they need to kind of really find the kind of balance. I know that there are media companies in the country who actually have own software that lets them test the A-B test. So they use two headlines for the same story. And then, you know, so these are things that's happening behind the scenes, you know, which is problematic, I think, because then I ask about editorial integrity.
Well, is it though? Because if you say that the story is the same, and in the end, the news that we're getting is verified, is accurate, is it a problem how we arrive there? I mean, if we get there via a misleading headline, but we find out real news, is that a problem?
Well, the word is misleading is there, then that's a problem already. I think if it's a sensationalized headline, I think sensationalism is subjective. But if you kind of twist a word because it's so easy to write a short headline without context, then if it's misleading, I think that's where the problem is.
Al Jazeera and other broadcasters regularly use amateur activist video, especially of the wars in the Middle East, which they then clearly state they can't independently verify. So here we are venturing into the realm of citizen journalism. If the pictures or videos can't be verified, should they be used at all?
I think it's a really tough question. I mean, we were talking about this much earlier in the start of the show about kind of among the journalism fraternity and people who are in the know and stuff, we know how to interpret words like alleged and claimed and things. I think a lot of general public don't. So I think we've got to be very careful about it. But I think the word unverified is very obvious. It's not kind of claimed. You know, there's a different kind of nuance to the word that I think people can get. I think in some cases you have to, like in the case of the airplanes crashing and stuff like that, if you have visuals and things, those are useful journalistically. But I think we need to be very careful, especially with 24-hour news cycles where we repeat them so much that it becomes ingrained that this is it and we forget about the unverified part. I think that's where the dangers come.
Where it becomes gospel, in other words.
Yes.
Coming back to that point about the law earlier that we were making, many countries do limit freedom of speech. Do you think that this is a trend to clamp down on social media, or are some countries learning to use it to their own advantage?
Yeah, I think it's to their convenience.
It's as and when.
It's as and when. I mean, a lot of countries use it for a lot of good. Even Malaysia uses, you know, we engage with people and we use that kind of things. But some countries are worse than others. And again, like I said, it's so easy to just keep blaming social media because we're all on there, when actually it's the issues that are surrounding it, that are being talked about it, that is the problem. If you talk to activists, for example, if you talk to activists from Vietnam and stuff, they will tell you horror stories about the kind of repression that they have. And we complain about lack of freedoms here, but it's nothing compared to that. At the same time, should we be saying, just because we're better than Vietnam, that we should live with what we have? I don't think so. I think the most important thing is, while we are looking for punitive action towards dealing with social media, we forget about the educational factor. And I think that if we're really serious about the idea of freedom of speech, even if you want to talk about it with responsibility, then we also have the responsibility to teach these people what do we mean by that, instead of making it arbitrary and kind of going, if I don't like it, I'll just shut it down, as opposed to kind of going, look, you know, we need to talk about these kind of issues, we need to learn etiquette, maybe educate in schools, you know.
These are the principles we're working with.
Yeah.
And let's talk about that.
Yeah.
Right. So with that being said, then, what message would you like to leave with us on the subject of journalism and social media and how we can all responsibly use it and consume it?
There's a journalist called, well, he's an academician now, Dan Gilmore from the US, and he was known as one of the first journalist bloggers. And he's got a book called Media Active. And really it's a thick book, but the idea really is that we need to realize that just because we use social media and on the internet, it doesn't mean that we're active users. We might be actively doing something, but we are all doing it in very passive ways. Because we also need to remember that these sites and things were created to make life easy for us. You know, so the idea of resharing and liking and things like that, these buttons are placed very strategically. This is years and years of research to make us want to engage with that app.
To make us one-click monsters.
One-click monsters and those kind of things. So it's very important, I think, for us to pause and the real way to be media active really is to think and ask questions. And, you know, it's not just asking questions about, is this information true, but is this person credible? Has this person, you know, is this a comment that I want to be associated with me? Even if you retweet it as just somebody else saying it. But, you know, we need to ask these kind of questions. And then I think if we do take that pause moment, it might slow social media down a bit, but it won't slow it down that much. And I think that will make a slight difference in terms of how we negotiate our space.
Thanks for your time, Nikki.
Thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with Nikki Cheung, lecturer and analyst on social media and journalism, and basically the areas in which those two overlap have been what we've been discussing on Live and Learn today on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.